On today's morning show, you're going to be hearing three different stories out of Hurricane Harvey. Two of them come from recent Carthage graduates and former voice students of mine who now live and work in Houston. One of them was forced to evacuate by the storm. The other was able to remain and actually be a heroic part of the rescue and recovery efforts there. But we begin with Kurt Oyen, for many years the technical director at the Racine Theater Guild, who moved back to Texas 10 years ago to begin a teaching career. He actually has survived two hurricanes, Hurricane Harvey and 10 years ago, Hurricane Ike. We began our conversation by having Kurt talk about the great state of Texas.
Well, it's not like any other place that you've ever lived. I was born in Iowa, grew up in Kansas, Louisiana. We moved to Texas in 87. And it's just that first place that really felt like home. It's the people, it's the food, it's being able to travel and never leave the state, being able to travel for an entire day and never leave the state. It's just a great place to be. And I don't, as much as I miss Wisconsin, we don't get snow here, so that's another great thing about Texas.
There you go. But you do get rain, of course, and of course,
yeah, unfortunately,
record-breaking amounts in these last few days. How long have you lived in, you live in Friendswood, Texas. How long have you been there?
10 years. 10 years since I left Wisconsin. And the first year I got here, we had 2 weeks of teaching and then 2 weeks off because of Hurricane Ike.
Wow.
And so now, 10 years later on the anniversary, we get another one. I think it's better than a 10-year pin, but
right.
Sometimes I think I'd rather have the pin.
Right. Of course. Yeah, this is a heck of an anniversary present. leading up to Harvey actually sort of striking Texas, how were you and your friends and colleagues and so on reacting to the news that Harvey was going to be something really, really big? And how does one prepare for something like that?
Well, no one really knew it was going to be a 4. And you know, the highest you can get in a hurricane is a Category 5, which was Ike. But Harvey was a 3. Where it was going to hit, we knew we were going to get the east wall of the hurricane as it cycles around. And the east wall is probably the messiest side of the storm. Center part of the storm is where all the destruction comes from. So as soon as it made landfall, I think like 40 minutes before it made landfall, it was slated as a Category 4 and just obliterated Rockport. And Rockport's a little town just east of Corpus Christi. There's not a lot of warning when a storm grows that quickly. So you prep yourself the best you can. When you're expecting a Category 3, you just kind of go to the grocery store, get what you need, hunker down, and either get ready to help while the storm's going on, or you make yourself available to help when the storm's over. Mm. And I think that's pretty much what everybody did, friends, family, colleagues. They closed down the district, like the entire district, on Thursday after school and let us know that we're not going to be open on Friday. And then the storm hits and just all hell broke loose. And they ended up closing the entire district for the rest of the week with the hopes of resuming back on the 5th.
Right.
And a lot of that's just dependent on damage and the assessments that they have to do. But our district has 6 high schools. I think there's probably upwards of 20 junior highs and about 42 elementary schools.
Wow. At the height of the storm, at the height of the fury of Hurricane Harvey, what were you experiencing at your home? I mean, what does it sound like? What does it feel like in terms of what those kind of winds and that kind of rain is doing to the house in which you're hunkered down?
Non-stop rain, just rain, lots and lots of rain, to the point that I think everyone in Texas who used to fall asleep to those sound machines are writing letters to the company asking them to remove rainfall from their systems because it doesn't help us sleep anymore. Hmm. The winds, there were a lot of tornadoes that touched down. I think most of us all know what tornadoes sound like, but it's just watching trees bend and sway. We didn't see any debris flying around. We had a couple branches fall off the trees in the backyard. And if you want to experience it and you have a convertible, take the convertible off and go through a car wash.
Mm. Wow. But and hour after hour after hour.
Just nonstop.
Right. Where you live, were you ever under any threat of actual flooding? Was that a fear of any kind for you personally?
The back neighborhoods, or the back part of my neighborhood, I'm a little bit closer to higher ground. But just four streets down, they had people with 4 feet and 5 feet of water in their house. So, I mean, we're really close to Clear Creek, which divides the Galveston and Harris County lines. And once that starts to rise, man, it's just, there's no control on it. There's no levees for creeks and no levees for bayous. So just as it rises, it'll crest over its bank and start adding river water to rainwater, which adds insult to injury, really.
Right. Did you have to do anything to, for instance, protect your windows from the high winds, or was this not that kind of storm where you had to be worried about something like that?
That's actually one of the worst things you can do is, I mean, you can put plywood over your house, and that helps if you're going to evacuate, but if you're staying still, that's one of the worst things you can do because you're cutting back on any exits that you might have in an emergency. Normally, when you start flooding, the last thing you want to do is open and close your front door or back door, because that will just create wakes and possibly let in more water than you need. So you'd kind of exit through windows. And then it's a misconception to put duct tape X's across your window. That doesn't really help either. So most of the prep that we did and anyone else was really just get supplies, because once the devastation part hits and the flooding and you can't go anywhere, last thing you want to do is not have drinking water and not have some type of dry goods or canned food that you can survive off of.
Did you have power, or did you lose power at certain points?
That's where our guilt kicks in, because we had power running water the entire time. The water was rising up. Our street was flooded. I think the water got up at least 3/4 away up the driveway, which gave us about 10 feet of berth between the house and the water line. So we didn't sleep when it was raining. We tried to sleep when there were like those 1 hour or 2 hour lulls. And we'd get up and turn on the news and just leave the news on nonstop. And just felt guilty because, you know, we've got power. We can cook. We can shower. And a lot of other people just did not have that luxury.
Right. Many, many thousands of people didn't have those luxuries.
Oh, man, you would not believe. But the hardest part, I mean, Amy and I are doers. Amy's my fiance. And we've always got to be doing something. So watching other people in need and basically having your hands tied because you can't leave the house to go and help out. So just guilt is probably the hardest thing that we've gone through. Only watching people help and not being a part of it. It's just, you know me, I'm a doer.
Right. I can see how that would...
Sitting on the sidelines.
Sure.
Just kills me.
Right. I'm sure that was very, very hard. Can you just say a quick word about when you went for that last run to the grocery store before all of this hit? What did the shelves look like? Or were you there early enough? Were you proactive enough that there was plenty to choose from? Because I suspect that by the time Harvey hit, the shelves were pretty much bare in most of the grocery stores in the area.
Yeah, it was really grab what you can. I went in, and it's pretty uncommon for the grocery store to be as busy as it was at 6 a.m. right when they opened. But, you know, we went through. Everyone was cool. Everyone was calm. Some people looked a little bit more worried than others. But the bread is one of the first things to completely disappear. Hmm. Tortillas actually last longer on your countertop than bread does, so I was kind of surprised.
Huh.
There's either a lot of rookies at the grocery store, or everybody just wanted bread. the water was gone, but what was left is, you know, like energy drinks and sodas and everything. Nobody really needs any of that. Juices, nobody wants juices when you're trying to hydrate. So, but it was calm. And it was, again, Friday morning, and it was right when the storms were starting. and you had that one quick chance to hurry up and take care of business.
Right.
I know there's a lot of grocery stores that had to shut down in Alvin, which is a little bit farther west of here, and Lake Jackson, which is right along the Gulf Coast. They shut down, and then once the storms kind of backed off a little bit, they opened their store and just sold whatever was left that they had on their shelf, either sold or gave away, so that people could have something until the trucks come in. But I met a really nice lady at the grocery store in the morning. she was going for bread, and I let her go first, and she had a very familiar accent. Turns out she had just moved here with her husband as a volunteer firefighter from south part of Milwaukee.
Ah.
So when I asked her, it's like, where'd you move from? She goes, Wisconsin. I'm like, well, where in Wisconsin? And I think Brook Forest is what she said. Or Brookwood, sorry, Brookwood. And so I was like, well, I worked in Racine, went to UWM, and you know, we hit it off like we were old friends.
Huh.
And gave her the tip about the tortillas and told her she'd be fine. And she was calm, but you could tell, like a duck on water, calm on the top and freaking out on the bottom.
Right. And it's a good thing she could speak to an experienced Texan and get a little advice.
Oh, yeah.
Because most of us around here know little or nothing about the best way to weather a hurricane. So, Kurt, do you know anything about the state of affairs at the high school where you teach, Clear Falls High School? You obviously haven't been there yet. Any even anecdotal information about what kind of damage the school sustained?
Sunday evening, I guess there was a lull, a little bit of a lull in the rain before the next deluge started. And someone that lives in that neighborhood is an avid drone photographer. So he or she flew their drone over the two neighborhoods that are on either side of the campus and send out shots of the water in the parking lots. And, I mean, the school sits up pretty high, but there's always the possibility of a fire door in the ceiling not being completely shut. And water just starting to get in, but this wouldn't have been just a little bit of water. They're supposed to do the damage assessments at some point this week. I think they may have even started today to figure out when they can let people back in. So they've already told us you can't go back into the building, but, well, I'm going anyway because I kind of want to see what we're up against. And then the worst neighborhood next to it, it's an older neighborhood. I think they built in like the late 70s, early 80s, was just inundated. And that's where a lot of our kids and even teachers live. Yeah. So I'm actually headed there around noon today to help my former roommate and his wife wipe out whatever we need to wipe out from the house. The Clear Falls students have been outstanding. Yesterday, pretty much every athlete that we had that was able was at the HEB, which is a local grocery store, and they were stocking and cleaning and bagging people's groceries. You know, kids don't work there. They just, it's a community thing.
Wow.
And I know you guys understand that, but it was just, you drop what you're doing and do what you can if you can.
Right. And of course, you felt
the spirit that came through.
Yeah. And of course, you felt all this frustration during the storm itself at being unable to help. But of course, given your expertise, now is the moment when you get to pitch in and really make a difference with this gigantic cleanup effort that now gets underway. So the story of Harvey, of course, is far from over. But you're no longer stranded. You can go where you need to go now, and that has to feel great.
It feels outstanding. I know there's still more water to come. They had to open up the reservoirs because they were overfilling, which would have caused more flooding for the people who live around them. And so the Attucks and Baker Reservoir, they had to open those to let water drain into Buffalo Bayou, which takes that out to the Gulf of Mexico, or at least Galveston Bay, which, again, it's more water on top of water that's already here. And but people are braced for it. It's a decision that had to be made. It's not an easy one. But I mean, you've seen the coverage. People are coming out of the woodwork and helping each other. I think when we were watching the news, we local news was more informative, to the point, like, you know, you can't go this way, this is what this is going on, or here's what's going on in these neighborhoods. But it was more information than anything else. And when the national news came on, we just turned the TV off. Because the first thing that they get is this, like, they made it look like the trailer of the latest Total Devastation movie that's coming out. It's like the guy's standing there, he's like, absolute destruction and devastation in Houston. I'm like, dude, calm down. I've got friends that are watching this, and you're freaking them out. You know, it just, they didn't help.
Right.
I know that they meant to, but they did a pretty lousy job. And sometimes it's just best to let the storm end, let us do what we do, and then ask us what we need. Hmm. Instead of firing off, what do you need? It's Sunday, and storm still has two more days. So pump the brakes, raise some money, and go from there. So really, really excited about the cleanup. I know everything's going to go back to normal. Hopefully not completely normal, because it's beautiful the way everyone was working together, and I hope it stays that way.
Absolutely.
The hate was gone. There's no us. There's no them. There's no the others. It's just Houstonians, Texans.
Right.
Texas helping Texas, and it's an awesome thing.
Yeah, all in it together. Kurt Oyen, he teaches at Clear Falls High School, makes his home in Friendswood, Texas. Kurt, I really appreciate you taking the time to be part of the morning show today. It's wonderful to hear your voice, and we wish you and all of your fellow Texans only the very best as you move on from here. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
And now we're going to be spending time with someone who has been something of a hero in the midst of this chaos with Hurricane Harvey. Those of us who've been watching the television coverage have seen all kinds of instances of heroic actions, and not just by first responders and people, in a sense, wearing official uniforms, but also by ordinary citizens in the Houston area trying to pitch in whatever way they can, and some Houston citizens who have actually engaged in actual rescue of people stranded in their homes and fearing for their lives. One such hero is someone that I know personally because he was a voice student of mine at Carthage College. Brett Harmeling was a graduate at Carthage in 2010, I believe. Education was his major, Broadfield Sciences his minor. And Brett is now living in Houston, working as a financial planner. And over the last few days of Hurricane Harvey, Brett has undertaken a role he never could have imagined for himself. First of all, Brett Harmeling, thank you for making time in your schedule to be part of the morning show. It's good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, thank you, Greg, for the introduction and whatnot.
Ahead of us talking about your heroic actions, I want you to just say a word about the city of Houston, where you have lived, I think, for the last 5 years or so, and what this city is like and what it means to you, even before we start talking about Harvey.
Got it. So Houston has become a home to me over the past 5 years. I moved here taking a job opportunity that engaged my professional communication and leadership skills back in 2012. And ever since, I've just seen Houston really come together as an amazing city. I moved to Houston from Chicago. I'll always love Chicago, but Houston having year-round summers essentially has been a blessing to not have to deal with the Midwestern winters. Also, the opportunity and growth that Houston has the capability to grow into is something that I've never seen. There's opportunities in pretty much every industry here. Even when oil and gas is down, there's still plenty of things people can get their hands involved in and generate an income for their family and future. So,
well said. Yeah.
I found a good church down here called Ecclesia. I'm a part of several organizations, one of those being the Mankind Project, and I'm also heavily involved with Big Power Yoga, which is not just a yoga studio, it's a beautiful community of people that are out to do big things in the world and make a big impact. So I'm really grateful to have found those communities years ago.
Cool. Well, and you've certainly made an impact on a lot of people's lives in the course of this storm. Ahead of us talking about some of these heroic measures you take, I just want to know what it was like for you as someone experiencing their very first hurricane. I mean, you haven't really lived in Houston long enough to have experienced, for instance, the big hurricane that hit the area 10 years ago. So this was your first hurricane. How scary was it as Harvey was approaching, and what were you doing to prepare for it?
So given that I know that I, where I reside in Houston is near Memorial Park, and I wasn't in any imminent danger of being flooded, I also live on the fifth floor of a mid-rise complex, and so I knew that I wasn't going to have a problem with anything maybe besides power, and so we didn't actually lose power, and so that took my own personal fear out of the mix, and so when I knew that I was going to be okay, it's not like a tornado where it comes in and just hits and it's gone. It's like it's been dark clouds, rain, constant heavy rain, and moderate to strong winds for, you know, since last week Saturday. So what happened is Friday everyone went to bed thinking, okay, the hurricane's not really that bad yet. Well, they woke up, and I don't know what the statistic is, but the water rose so much in such a short period of time that what happens is, since we're in Houston and everything drains to the coast, water compounds from even Austin and San Antonio and makes its way through Houston. So if we get 20 inches of rain here, that's not even including the 20 inches of rain or wherever else got the rain that where the water runs through Houston. And so areas flood really quick. The reservoirs were cresting, which means overflowing. And so they had to release those, and they released them yesterday. And so today it's sunny, beautiful here in Houston. However, there's still massive flooding. There's still people on roofs. I mean, the work is nowhere even close to being done. I would say there's probably 1,000 people that are still need to be rescued.
Wow. So
I wanted to take time today just to create awareness around an event that I didn't think would have been so tragic and devastating, and it happened. And so with that being said, it's important. I believe it's important as human beings to always be prepared for situations, whether it's a health problem, a financial problem, or a natural disaster, things that are out of our control. And so that's, you know, one of the things that I personally do with my clients is make sure that they are prepared for as many of life's events, whether they're positive or negative, that they can be.
Yeah. So. Good philosophy. So at what point, Brett, did it occur to you that you had a vehicle that could make its way through some of these floodwaters and that you could actually get out there and maybe rescue some people from imminent danger? I mean, at what point did that occur to you? Or even ahead of Harvey hitting, did you already have that in your head that this was something that you could do?
Immediately. So my friend CJ Bro started a company called Tactical Off-Road, and we build Jeeps that go pretty much anywhere in the country. And so when we built my Jeep, I knew my Jeeps. It's like a warrior or a person in karate knows their skills. They know what they can, they know the tools that they have that they can use. And so one thing going hand in hand with that is sorry, I'm getting another call. One thing going with that is that they were able to, you know, I was able to know the capabilities of my own vehicle without risking putting myself in danger. And so that's one thing that I want to also communicate is that if you don't know, Jeeps are great vehicles, but if you don't know what its capability is, it's a worse situation if you put yourself in harm's way, because then someone else has to rescue you.
Absolutely. So explain what makes your Jeep Wrangler Rubicon such a special vehicle and the way in which it was sort of custom built to be perfect for what you ended up using it for.
Yeah, so we put on it's called a bolt-on coilover suspension kit from Evo Manufacturing out in California. It's essentially like a professional-grade racing suspension that's adjustable from 3.5 to 6 inches. So we had it adjusted to its maximum height. And then I'm riding on 37-inch tires that are all-terrain, made for rock climbing. So, you know, that's good as well because the treads disperse water in a way that other, you know, generic tires don't, as well as there's a lot of stuff. So my tires are pretty torn up because there's a lot of stuff that you're going over that you don't know what it is under the water. And so oftentimes people can get flat tires and whatnot. Well, these tires, you know, save the day because they can go over nails and glass. And unless it's a huge, sharp object, they have a small chance of deflating.
Mm. So how did the rescue missions begin in terms of knowing where to go, knowing who needed help? I mean, how did you know where to go? How did you know where there were people who needed rescuing?
That's a great question, Greg. So it started off, my friend Rafael Cordova owns a house in the Heights, and the bayou had flooded over T.C. Jester and was rising. And so due to him being my friend, I was like, I need to come get you. And so we traversed through the bayou. It was about 3.5 feet of water, so the water at times would be almost over my hood. And we got him, and it was like a scene out of a movie. When we got to the other side of this of the bayou and turned the corner, there was over 100 people there stranded, almost as if they were on an island with absolutely nothing. The look in their eyes, I'll never forget. And that's when I knew, this is Saturday morning, that's when I knew that Houston needed my help and the help of everyone here. And, you know, so with that going said, I'm using the tools that I have, and so are other people. You know, I get humbled when people ask to do interviews, and I say, you know, we're all in this together. I'm doing what I know how to do best, and I'm on the ground, you know, boots on the ground, Jeep on the ground, whatever you want to call it, and I'm out there and relaying the messages of how areas are, you know, delivering people and goods to convention centers. When I say that I rescued or saved 54 people, that's the amount of people that I believe that would have been in life-threatening situation. I've had well over 100 people in my Jeep transported, whether that mean for volunteer efforts or to just dry land. Like, hey, can you take me to my friend's house?
Right.
Things like that. And what's cool, the social media awareness factor, which I take pride in, because a lot of the efforts that were able to happen from that. I had people reaching out all over the country asking me to save their parents, their friends. And if I couldn't, or if I wasn't in that area because I was busy, I had several other people that I could reach out to for the message. And those people went out of their way to handle the same situation. And so through my essentially social media page, it was a catalyst for a lot of people to, you know, get help.
Right, to make connections and make it happen one way or another. When you would rescue somebody, for instance, were you rescuing people who were up on their roofs? Or I mean, typically, what was the situation that you would find when you got to, for instance, somebody's home where they are stranded there? Where would they be, and what was involved for you besides just driving your vehicle there? Then what would you do?
Yeah. Yep. So once you get to the scene, then depending on so there's a lot of variables, but depending on their physical capability and age, and what they had, if they had dogs or, you know, things that they had, we had to get serious and have some real conversations about what they needed and what they wanted. And so at certain points, like there was one elderly couple that I had to literally swim to their roof. Like, so I had to get out of my Jeep, park it so that it was away. I don't know if you know how Houston set up, but where the bayous go, the water floods quick. And so then you could be like 20 feet away and the water over there could be 10 feet deep, and where you are, there could be a foot deep.
Wow.
And so I just gauged the depth of the water based on the signs, the mailboxes, things like that. People would be on their front porches, you know, oftentimes I'd look for the door handle on the door, and that would be a good gauge of how high the water was. Once again, I didn't drive my vehicle anywhere where I knew that I would get stuck, because then I would become a problem, and I didn't want to become another person's problem or put myself in danger.
Right.
And so oftentimes it was just pulling up, because I went to the communities and areas,
it was either Jeep, like our high water vehicle, or boat. And so either people would get transferred from boat on a, from a rescue team. Like, this wasn't just me. By the way, there's like hundreds of people that have helped out. And so I'm just posting my experience to create awareness that this is a real thing happening right now.
Right. And you were part of a huge effort. And what what the article on the Carthage website mentions is that at some point you actually were welcomed by county authorities into their sort of coordinated response team. Can you explain what that means? I mean, what sort of difference did that make when this became more than just kind of your own individual effort?
Yeah, so that gave me access to having so the people that I was attached to were the Harris County Attorney General's office, and we had officers that were in communication with people in the helicopters. And so, you know, you can watch the news, but that doesn't tell you where the access points and people are actually needing to save. Getting out there and being on the ground is like how we were able to identify the people in the most amount of need. And when the storm kind of left yesterday, it absolutely like swiped out Port Aransas. And so, like I said, there's still thousands of people just waiting to be picked up. And that's a boat situation. They're in deep water over there. But also what that gave me access to is we had the credentials in my Jeep to go to basically be a government-officiated vehicle. So I didn't have to wait in lines. I could go around people. I could get people that were in critical condition to medical attention faster. I had lights, you know, in my vehicle that allowed us to do that, as well as the individual that I was riding, basically my co-pilot riding around with. And he would pull the address. We'd go there. He'd be in communication with the helicopter or whoever needed to be, and then we would pursue the mission. I call it a mission. Everyone's a little bit different.
Right. So it's like you were deputized, which is really interesting.
Yeah, pretty much. That's what it felt like.
Yeah. In the early going, before that occurred, when you're just kind of doing this on your own, how did you know where you could take people? What information did you have at your disposal in terms of what shelters there were or where it was safe to deposit people?
Yeah, so that information is all very well communicated via news, social media outlets, Facebook, Instagram, that kind of thing. And, you know, when we first started this, I mean, George R. Brown, we were like, okay, this will be great, 5,000 people, no problem. Well, then we capped it at 8,000, and then we had to start bringing people to the NRG Center, and the Toyota Center also opened, and then other churches and people started opening their doors because they realized the severity of the problem. But going in there, you know, you see people, and you look at them and you think that they have had to basically say goodbye to, you know, all the things that they've collected and things that are important to them in their life, and all they had was right there with them. You know, that was hard for me to see. And at the same time, I just, you know, I offered love and support. I prayed with some people, told them I love them, told them that we're going to get through this together, just to keep the positive vibes going. You know, people tend to go into victim or shame mode. And the truth is, you know, this didn't happen to them. This happened for them. So whatever that means, to each individual is different, but you have to take this as an opportunity to rebuild, to recenter, refocus, and move forward in a way that we may have not been living previously.
Right. So through all of this ordeal, tell us how much you've slept. I mean, when did you sleep? Where did you sleep? And how are you physically feeling right now?
So between Friday night and today, I have slept. So we're at about 15 hours since last week. And I don't require a lot of sleep. The reason that the night before I got to get some sleep as well is I had to bring a lady to Austin whose mother had passed away. And she couldn't get out of town for 3 days, and so finally I was able to get her out of here and be with her her family in Austin. And so I actually stayed in Austin that night so that I could be away from the scene to get some sleep. what I mean by that is otherwise I lay in my bed and I just think about the people that need my help now, and then I can't sleep because I'm here.
Right.
I was physically not here, so I couldn't do it. I took myself out for a couple hours before I headed back in the morning.
So, for instance, we're recording this on Thursday morning, and are you still busy with this rescue effort? I mean, are you about to drive out and find someone else to rescue?
That's the reason you only get 15 minutes of my time. I have two people right now stranded at a hotel that hasn't had power since Monday, that have ran out of food, ran out of power, ran out of water. And so I'm going to show up. This is a prediction, and it's as positive as it can be. And I'm going to guess that there's probably 100 other people that are in the same situation, and these are the people that just I was able to get, like, once again, someone from out of state, I believe they're from Chicago, called me and said, hey, my parents are they're there. I don't know what's going on. I don't know if you can even get to them. Please check it out. And so I reached out to my network. I got a Jeep full of food and water that I'm going to bring over there. Whether or not they need to be rescued, I don't know if that, you know, because they need somewhere to go. I don't just pick up people and drop them off and say good luck. I make sure they're in a secure, safe, and dry area.
Right. Well, keep your phone charged and your gas tank full, and be safe, Brett Harmeling. And thank you so much for taking time from this important work to share your really important story on the morning show. I appreciate it. I'm proud of you. And take care.
All right. Thank you, Greg. Have a wonderful day.
The third and final story about Hurricane Harvey is going to come from another former voice student of mine, a Carthage grad by the name of Matt Tomey, who now lives and works in Houston for a company called Octagon, the world's largest sports consulting agency. And his move to Houston, Texas is actually a move back to his home state. Matt was born in Austin, Texas many years ago. His family eventually moved up to Wisconsin. As I already said, he is a graduate of Carthage. And he has just lived through his very first hurricane. And unlike our first two guests in this hour, Matt actually had to evacuate and was part of that whole frightening experience of surviving Harvey by the skin of his teeth. Matt Tomey, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm sure you are in the sense of being safe and warm and dry in Austin, your hometown. That's where you
Absolutely.
Are right now. First of all, how long ago did you move to Houston and take this position with Octagon?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started with Octagon on August 14th. So just about 2 weeks ago, made a last-minute move for a pretty cool job. But when the time the hurricane hit, I had almost been there 2 weeks.
Wow. So this is a heck of a homecoming present to live through something so dramatic. So in the
Absolutely.
early going, it looked like you were not going to be displaced. Talk briefly about the front part of Harvey and how safe you felt and for how long.
Yeah, absolutely. So at first, really, it looked like the eye of the storm was heading towards Corpus Christi. And meteorologists were projecting that we were going to get a lot of rain. But we weren't going to get any high winds, which would lead to a lot of damage. It was just going to be some flooding. For me, I live on the third floor of an apartment complex, and my car is in a parking garage, so I wasn't too worried about getting flooded out. Went and stocked up on food in that, felt pretty safe. And our area where we live is the Energy Corridor, which is on the west side of Houston, right along I-10.
And can you explain what that means, the Energy Corridor?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the Energy Corridor is essentially where all the large oil and gas corporations are headquartered. So it's kind of like a big corporate business park, but it's kind of become a more of a livable place for young professionals and their families, just kind of a new kind of modern area, not far from downtown and midtown, about 15 minutes, but just kind of close to work for a lot of folks with a lot of major, you know, Fortune 500 companies living in or operating in that area there.
Right. So you were essentially in your apartment, essentially stranded in your apartment, I suppose, for, I think you said, 72 hours.
Yeah. We got out of work early on the Friday when it hit. We were left the office at about 2. And from that point on, I was just in the apartment. So when the storm hit Friday night, just kind of hunkered down and actually made it until Sunday evening was when I eventually lost power. Monday evening was when I lost power.
You lost power and you lost water.
What was that?
You lost power and lost water.
Yes. Yep, we lost power and we lost water. So it was kind of actually sitting there watching TV, just doing some laundry, trying to kill some time, starting to get a little bit of cabin fever. And, yeah, power went out, and, you know, there was really nothing else to do at that point. So waited it out over that night, and Tuesday morning was finally when the grocery store said they weren't going to be open for a while, and overnight. So when I checked on Monday evening how many folks had power in Houston, the energy company was only reporting about 90,000 people without power. You know, in a city of millions, pretty small percentage.
Right.
By morning, that had already grown to over 120,000, and is expected to grow from there. So I knew I wasn't going to get power back on anytime soon. So that was kind of when we made the call. You know, now's the time to get out. We saw a route. If we kind of made our way through some different areas of town, we'd be able to get to Highway 290 and get up to Austin. So just kind of made a last-minute decision with my a friend in town here who I work with, and we got out of town. So,
how were you able to get information at that point? I mean, with no electricity in your building?
Yeah, I used a resource called drivetexas.org, and basically all the emergency personnel around the state report road closures and why they're closed, just wherever they're at. So they were reporting all these different roads that either they had water but you could pass, or they were completely closed and there was no way you could get around them. So I was just kind of using that to try to find the best route. As far as news information, I was just kind of relying on my cell phone. Cell service was still really strong in my area, and I had a few battery backups, so I was able to make it. But yeah, I was just kind of relying majority actually on Twitter by people reporting different outages and new developments and that sort of thing.
Wow. I know that you made your way to, I think your boss and the two of you made your way to Austin. How crowded an evacuation was this, or had most people already evacuated by that point?
I think we were kind of in the middle of the two big evacuations that happened. You know, one initially right before that storm and on the first day, and now one is kind of happening now again. So we were kind of in the middle of it. We didn't have a lot of traffic. The hardest thing was just getting around town. So Kevin usually only lives about 7 to 8 minutes away from me. It took me close to an hour to actually get to his apartment because I had to go all the way into downtown and come. I live north of him, and I actually had to come up from the south in order to get to his apartment. Because the Buffalo Bayou, which is the one of the main ways the reservoir is emptied, it's the kind of the main line that they use, that was 30 feet over its banks.
Wow.
So there was no way I could pass that. So it took us a while to get that, but, you know, probably another hour to get out of town once I picked him up. But then it was smooth sailing from there. As soon as we got out of Houston, we had blue skies and just kind of easy going on Highway 290. There were some cars on it, but it was by no means any heavy traffic.
So it wasn't the kind of nightmarish bumper-to-bumper image that we sometimes see when there are dramatic evacuations. Sounds like you were fortunate in a couple of different ways.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. We got out at a good time, yeah. So, I mean, all in all, it took us about 3.5 hours to get up here to Austin, which is an hour longer than it would usually take you, but still a great time for the situation we had to deal with in that. So
what did you see as you were driving around Houston? What sorts of scenes of devastation, or was that in other parts of Houston that and you didn't really see any too much directly?
Yeah, the east side of Houston got hit the worst, and I really didn't have to head over to that side. I live on the west side of town, but that west side of town in my last 24 hours there is really when it got bad. There was no flooding near my apartment prior to when I woke up Tuesday morning, and that's when finally the bayou started taking over the waters in my area. So that was kind of a first sign, but I had to cross an overpass over Highway 8. And the way that highway is built is it kind of looks like a giant ravine with the road at the bottom. It was completely full up to the bridge that I was on. And, you know, you think of the large overpass signs that are maybe 30 feet, you know, above your cars when you're driving on the highway. The water was touching the bottom of those.
Wow.
So that was something that I had never seen or experienced, and was just kind of, I couldn't believe it. And there were people, you know, just coming by and taking pictures of it. You know, on the overpass, you're pretty safe because the water, you know, wasn't cresting over that road yet. But it was just absolutely crazy to see. I mean, there were homes that you'd pass, you know, if you look down into a neighborhood where the water was up to the second story. And, you know, there's just boats everywhere trying to get people out. And quite honestly, it seemed like a well-oiled machine with the way they were doing it. There was kind of a system in place for the few boats that I saw in one neighborhood. Just kind of, they were making a loop and dropping people off, and they'd head right back out again. So they were pretty efficient in getting people out of their homes, but it was definitely a sight that I hope I don't have to encounter again.
Right. So you are lucky to have relatives in Austin, where you were born, and so that's where you are right now. At what point do you think you're going to be able to return to Houston, and do you have any idea at what point you're going to be returning to work?
Yeah, I think we're going to try to make it back on Monday. Our office is supposed to open up back on Tuesday. Not exactly sure if that's going to happen because most of the first floor was underwater. They had some pretty significant flooding. And while we're on the seventh floor, elevators may be out. We know our storage unit, where all of our foam fingers and stuff that we give out at football games and that, we know that got flooded. So we're going to have to do some clean out of that and re-inventory and get a couple of new orders placed. But, yeah, so we're hoping head back Monday, hopefully in the office Tuesday. But, you know, we're waiting to hear from our building managers and that to see if we can get back in. And that'll really dictate when we decide to head back to town.
Right. As someone who works for a sports consulting firm, I have a feeling you have as good an idea as any of us about the role that athletic organizations and sports teams can play in terms of rebuilding morale for the state of Texas and its citizens. I mean, although it might seem like kind of a frill or a fluff right now, it's actually important that some of this activity go on.
Absolutely. You know, when you think about some of the most powerful brands in the world, it does, you know, sports teams are one of the first ones that come to mind. Not only because of the amount of money and the financial resources that they have, but also their impact on their communities and the influence they have. And, you know, when they really start to band together like they're doing now with all these, I mean, you see sports organizations and brands from all over the United States and around the world donating to the cause right now. I mean, one guy that's just amazing right now is J.J. Watt, Wisconsin native, and, you know, he's already raised over $12 million through his foundation for Harvey Relief. So, you know, when it may seem, you know, a lot of people may see them as frivolous or, you know, maybe they think sports teams spend a lot of money and it doesn't exactly matter. At the end of the day, when, you know, push comes to shove, they're always willing to help out and give millions on millions of dollars to help their communities because they know, I mean, without their fans, they don't have a business and, you know, they don't have a livelihood. And so you got to take care of your home place first and make sure they're all right. So, I mean, not just because it's so that you survive, but because it's the right thing to do. And that's one thing that I think so many sports organizations have is just a really great understanding of corporate social responsibility and community relations. And it's fantastic to see them reaching out and really giving everything they can back to the communities where, you know, where they operate.
Matt Tomey, Carthage graduate, now a proud resident of Houston, hoping to return to Houston soon. Matt Tomey, thank you for sharing your story and very best wishes to you and all the folks of Texas.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Greg.